Hey guys, did you know that you can subscribe to the Investor Coaching Show podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts? When you subscribe, you get notifications with new episodes so you never have to go looking for an episode or worry about what you've missed. So if you're on your phone or computer, go ahead and pause the episode real quick and become a subscriber. If you're not sure how to subscribe, go to paulwinkler.com/how-to-subscribe, all one word, how to subscribe, for instructions, or click the link in the show note. Now let's get started.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
And welcome. This is the Investor Coaching Show, and I am Paul Winkler, along with Ira Work and Evan Varner. Now Evan's doing air drums. He's taking my job.
They were my newest air drums.
That was nice, man. That was a good kit. You got to know that. Clear. It's like acrylic. It's awesome. Okay, this could be the worst. You guys, I know you're here. People looking around to buy a house.
Yes.
And they're going, shell-shocked, right? With prices. All
yes.
Over the place. I mean, not just here in Nashville. I mean, everywhere.
Yep.
Could be the worst market for first-time home buyers, experts say, according to CNBC. This is a big deal right now. First home is always a big decision, and right now it's kind of rough. Financial people are saying it could be the worst market for home buyers they've ever seen. Caution clients to perhaps wait. But if I'm wrong, that's the hard thing.
Yeah.
You know, you go, well, what if it's even worse? But, you know, there are a lot of things going on that you just kind of, we see cycles and you just don't know when the cycle's going to end.
That, and in addition to, I think, first-time home buyers, it's particularly hitting singles or just couples that don't have children. I mean, just because of the property availability and that kind of that niche.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've actually been going through this with Justin for probably a year.
Really?
And, you know, he's Navy submarine officer. He's got a good income, single, so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he is so mobile that, you know, it kind of starts to fall into the realm of market timing of, well, if I buy in New Hampshire, I may be gone in 8 months. You know, he can't
That's really
keep it
tough.
For 10 years or something like that. But he sees these prices going up, and in his world, Dad, I've lost $200,000 just living in this apartment for the last year and a half. You know, it's driving him nuts.
Yeah.
And he's not unique.
Well, you know, here I crunched some numbers on this.
Yeah.
Just for the fun of it, because I got to playing around with things and just looking at history and... One paragraph that stood out to me in this article is this one. Not only has the pandemic failed to cool the hot housing market, it has kicked it into higher gear. You know, of course, so what you got going on is people that were once working in the big cities moving out to the country and going, hey, this isn't too bad here, you know, not smelling smog every morning and hearing car horns and you know, actually being able to walk and you know, see grass and see trees and squirrels. And what is that thing? Oh, this reminds me of, you know, the... Growing up in upstate New York, the city people would come out and the farmers got so upset with them. But I told this story a couple weeks ago, but it was so funny. If you didn't hear it, they come out from New York City and they decide to go hunting for deer. And literally the cows got, the farmers started putting cow, COW, spray painting their cows. It's just a cow. You know, they just don't shoot this thing.
That's the longest horns I've ever seen on a deer.
Wow. Sometimes it's a shock to get out in the country and see things you've never seen before. But what happened is they're able to go and phone in or dial in or get on their computer and sit in meetings
right
in the city, and they're still working out of California, but they're living in Nevada, or they're living in Arizona, or they're living in Tennessee, or, you know, wherever.
Yep.
And that's really what's been going on. So what happened is that these people moving out has created more demand for housing in rural areas without the supply. And of course, you know, the birth rate of some of the new generations coming up, it's, you know, fairly big compared to even the baby boom generation. If they look at the number of millennials, and you know, the millennial population is just about as big as the baby boom generation in the number of people. So, you know, if you look at that and go, wow, okay, so yeah, there is something going on there. And then they're having kids and things like that. And now that's going to create even more demand. And then, of course, you got people coming in, you know, you still have immigration happening, whether it be legal or illegal. But anyway, so it says at the end of September, the average home price in the U.S. was $377,000, according to real estate broker Redfin. That's up 14% from the same month last year and a staggering 30% from September 2019, when the average selling price for a home was $291,000. Now, I hear this from people. I had heard from somebody talking this week and saying, you know, we're thinking about our house. You know, we want to think about leaving it to our kids, maybe our grandkids, and because they're not going to be able to afford a house at the rate. And I said, you know, it's not a straight line, guys.
Right.
Houses do not always go up as fast as we've been seeing lately. You know, sometimes they come down even. And you don't have that price appreciation. But a lot of people think that real estate by itself is this awesome investment, is what I find.
Right.
And I have to point out, well, you know, really, if you look at it, what drives this okay return historically is actually rent payments. You know, so if you look at rent payments and look at history, real estate, the value of it, or the level of appreciation is just slightly less than large U.S. stocks. And of course, as I always point out, you own real estate when you own stocks. But return-wise, it's okay, and the reason is because of that rent. Now, big increases really aren't that normal. If you look at the Census Bureau, and this is where I went and looked at some data on this, the median income of families in the United States back in 1970 is, and actually they've updated this data. Mm-hmm. It's $9,870 is the most recent data. Most recent data for the U.S., the median income in America in 2020, $67,521.
Wow.
Okay. So $9,800 to $67,000. So you're looking at that going, if you're a person receiving that annuity payment.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And fast forward, and you're looking at a pretty significant decrease, almost sevenfold.
Yeah.
Decrease in
purchasing. I'd stay home too.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you talk about. Yeah, a lot of times they can't get out because they can't afford to get out. Now, if you look at the home prices, okay, so that's income, about $10,000 to about $70,000. Let's just keep it nice and round here. Median home price in 1970, $24,002. Okay, so that's median home price. Median home price now, according to this article, was $377. I actually looked it up. As of May 2021, it's $329. As you know, so this is using, I'm using the most recent information out there, which was $329,000. Okay, so housing is up, income has gone up about 7 times, right? 6.8 times to be exact. Housing is up 13.7 times. Okay, wow. So housing has gone up more than income has, okay? But here's the thing that you don't see in the data. The average size of the house back then was 1,000 square foot.
Yeah, I was going to say about 1,200.
Yeah, not far off. 1,000 square foot.
Yeah.
1,000 square foot smaller house. Now, if you look at that and say, okay, so now back then it was 1,660 square feet in 1973. That's the earliest data that they had in the Census Bureau. And now it's 2679 square feet. So if you're just wondering how you compare to the rest of the nation, that's it, 2679 square feet. Now that is 61% more space that we have than we had back there. Now if you adjust for size.
Right.
So we're just doing a little math here. If we adjust for size, you have to bring that down. The number drops from 13.7 times. Remember, housing incomes went up by 7 times, right? Housing went up by just shy of 14 times. It brings it down to 8.5 times.
I was going to say, it's going to be pretty close to 7. Yeah.
Pretty doggone close. pretty doggone close to being the same. Is that not fascinating? Mm-hmm. And then you'll think of this, what do we have now that we didn't have back then? I mean, microwave ovens.
USB ports. USB. Talking refrigerators.
Phones that you just take with you.
Absolutely. A phone that you take with you. Yeah. Who's that? You know, how? Yeah. You're not tied to the kitchen every time you want to talk. And rotary telephone,
long,
what's that?
Curly phone cord.
Yeah.
And I bet there's
better heat and air.
200% more bathrooms in that house.
No question. Heat and air units. Yeah. More efficient. You can heat it more efficiently, you know, so with less energy.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to think to see, and you may have this number, I don't know.
I doubt.
But thinking about interest rates in the early 70s, uh-huh, in terms of the percentage of income on a payment of that average house then,
right.
You know, probably 13 or 14% mortgage rates.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To that twice the size house,
well, sure,
at a 3% rate now, I bet they're paying less per month.
Yes.
Than they were in 1970.
It is. I was listening to a 70s broadcast.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, he says, and we're back to 1975, he says. And he says, when your rent payment was only $200 and you could buy a Ford Mustang for $4,000.
Yeah.
And he says, that's why you could afford the Ford Mustangs, because it was only, but you know, he wasn't thinking about inflation.
Yeah.
Obviously. But you look at that and go, yeah, you know, and Evan, that's why we had to come up with, you know, I mean, remember balloon mortgages?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you basically had interest-only payments to keep the payments down.
An assumable loan was gold.
Oh, yeah, assumable loans, yeah.
Or Bitcoin.
My first house, my wife and I, our first house was an assumable loan.
Yeah.
And most people are like, what the heck is that?
Right.
You buy the house off of somebody else, you give them a down payment, and you take over their loan. And you know what? The down payment was next to nothing because real estate wasn't going up like it is now.
Yeah.
It was actually declining because the real estate had gone through this hot streak, and that whole period of time was very, very difficult. And it was because the tax laws changed. And when the tax laws changed, that actually drove down the value of real estate because the tax benefits of real estate went away.
Are you saying that Congress enacted a tax law that had adverse consequences, Paul?
No, I didn't say that.
Tell me it isn't so.
It wasn't me. I didn't say it. You know, so when at that, you say you factor that in, it's not as big of a deal, you know, as far as what the differential between housing prices now. So somebody say, I got to buy. And, you know, if you look at when you factor in this increase, you know, because remember the increase over the last year, they said in this article, is 30%, right? Well, you factor that in and it comes down to 5.9 times.
Yeah.
Remember, income went up by 7 times.
Yeah.
Housing prices, when you just take out that little 30% anomaly that we just had in bump in housing prices jumping
30%. Oh, just go back a couple years. Yeah, just go back a couple of years. Yeah.
Now, instead of that, it's only 5.9 times, which really is interesting from another standpoint. Because what I was doing, because I was on hyperdrive this morning looking for data, and I found this chart, fellas, and I'm going to turn it around so you can see. You can see, Evan and Ira, this chart.
Yeah.
This chart is going up from left to right at a gradual slope, up from left to right. So imagine, if you will, folks, a chart going back from 1970 through 2020 and a gradual upward slope. Now, it has bumps. It goes up and down and up and down. It almost looks like a stock market chart, but it is not. What it is a household income chart from 1970 until now, inflation adjusted.
Oh, uh-huh.
And why this is interesting to me, because you so often hear from people out there, those of you taking notes, having younger people telling you that things are worse now than they've ever been. My life is worse. It's terrible. Our future is dismal and bleak and awful. What this sloping line going up from left to right is telling us is that household incomes have actually been growing from the average household income, inflation adjusted from 1970 was $50,000. Now, on average, it's about $70,000. So what we're seeing is that people's standards of living are actually getting better,
yep,
not worse. Optimism is, Evan?
Rational.
Rational.
So
see, Evan gave me that book.
So we have, you know, we talk about the, a particular presentation on experiencing the American dream.
Yes.
And one of the assertions is that the American dream is alive and well. Because you see a lot of critics that, you know, oh, unemployment's bad, housing's, you know, the world's ending.
Yeah.
And we hear this term, the vanishing middle class, uh-huh, all the time.
Yeah.
And if you look at the data, what you see is it's true. The lower middle class and middle class are vanishing, mm-hmm, as a percentage of the population.
Right.
But where they're going
to the upper class
is upper middle class and rich. They're not going to poverty.
Isn't that interesting?
And so the middle class is moving up the ladder, just like that housing chart showed.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the American dream is absolutely alive and well.
Yeah, it is. It's and you hear this, and typically the reason you hear it is, and both sides do this, they use data to try to drive a political agenda.
It's recency bias.
And it is recency bias. And, you know, they feel a little bit bad right now. It's kind of like going back to that experiment when we bring kids back from summer vacation. And all we can remember is the bad stuff.
Right.
And what I'm doing is I'm saying we're going to the end of the year. You know, where we're going to look at and we're going to say, you know what? It has been a pretty good ride over the past 40, 50 years.
Yep.
It has actually been okay 50 years in this particular case. But, you know, it is interesting when we look at how incomes have been changing. And when we look at real estate, yeah, it is. It's a tough time to buy a new house. But, you know, here's the point I like to make. It is a tough time, but they aren't extraordinarily high compared to historical norms when you take into account income changes over the past 50 years. When you look at it that way, it's not extraordinary. Now, would I hang out and wait? Maybe. I might be. And, you know, it is not the end of the world if you rent for a little longer and you kind of wait it out and wait for more supply, because there's stuff going up all around us. There's stuff going up all around us. The amount of supply that will probably come online in the next few years is astounding.
Or foreclosures from COVID fallout still in the pipeline. But I will say,
it could be. Yeah.
If you live in Williamson County and you're retiring to like Lewisburg this month, that's probably a pretty good deal.
You know, a point well made. Yeah. You know? Because that is a really good point that if you're in an area that's hot, and you're going to an area where there's not that much demand,
right,
you sell at that hot price and you buy where there's not as much demand.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the one that takes it on the chin. You know, it's, you know, the person that buys it from you might. We don't know that either. But,
correct,
you know, the reality is if we knew that, what we'd do is like a short housing or something like that. But we don't know that.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And we really don't. So, you know, just really be careful about this type of stuff. This is a financial planning conversation. Should I buy? Should I stay? Should I go now? What should I do? And it can really depend for people. But, you know, don't make a move for emotional reasons is really what
absolutely
I'm trying to say.
All right. Let's change gears now.
Okay, so in the top news today, this is from Investment News. This
oh boy.
Publication for financial advisors. DOLs, I think we're going to have a different take on this than they do. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I think I'm let you guys. Okay. DOL's ESG rule proposal bodes well for 401ks. You're already laughing. Department of Labor earlier this month issued a much anticipated rule on the use of ESG, environmental, social, and governance investments in retirement plans, effectively walking back two Trump-era rules that were finalized last year. The proposed rule bodes extremely well for ESG investment managers, especially because of the regulator clarified that target date funds and other default products that use the investment criteria are permissible in 401ks.
Wow.
The line in that is to me, and I want you guys to comment on this. The proposed rule bodes extremely well for ESG investment managers. Does that say anything that the...
About participants? Yeah.
Nailed it, Evan.
I mean, like,
yes.
Do you represent the voters or do you represent the ESG investment companies?
Exactly. Thank you.
They represent their sponsors.
That, to me, is the problem with this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
In essence, what do we have going on in Washington right now?
Nothing.
Yeah. Total dysfunction is just a multiple choice question.
I think I threw a softball over the plate.
Waka waka.
Paul, don't do that. Do not throw something that easy to Ira. Okay, so what do we have? What is one of the major goals in Washington environmental standards? Right?
I mean, that's Green New Deal and climate change and all that.
And we see, as we said, record profits, huge profits where? Oil companies, as we talked about. Oil companies, huge profits. Why? Because they are looking at themselves and going, you know, bummer of a birthmark, Hal. Remember Far Side? You got the two deer. The two deer in the woods. If you haven't seen this, Gary Larson, Far Side. One of them has a target on his chest, and that's his birthmark. So the oil companies are going, bummer of a birthmark that we've got on ourselves right now.
Right.
And you're telling us to go and put money into windmills and solar panels and things that we're looking at going, and this is better how for the environment?
Right.
And, you know, there was a guy that did a video a while back. It was fascinating. And I don't remember. He was a staunch environmentalist, young guy. And he's going through and looking at the various technologies. And he's talking about oil and he's talking about the issues of global. You know, he's very much a global warming kind of guy. And, you know, I'm not taking a stance. I'm not going to say one way or another on that because there are people on both sides of the fence. And this is not the point of this.
And that's what creates a market, by the way.
Yes. So what he said was this. He says, okay, I have a problem with oil is based in carbon and, you know, carbon emissions and all of this stuff. He says that's where he came from. And he says, I used to believe in wind power. I used to believe in solar panels, and I am getting to the point where I do not see them. And he's even talking about where you have these contraptions where you send water up a grade and you bring it down and you actually create electricity, kind of like, you know, where you have in the rivers, you have these energy producing, you know, as the river's moving downstream and it produces energy that way.
It's kind of like a turbine.
Yeah, exactly. So he says, you know, I've even looked at that. He says, this does not work. This is not sustainable. You know what his solution was? And he's going all around the world and he's saying, you know, France is like completely almost on this. Switzerland almost completely on this. Nuclear.
I'd vote for that in a second.
Yeah.
I will go on record for that one.
And, you know, so he's saying that, and he's talking about the amount of waste produced, and he says if you take from the very, very beginning of time, all the waste, you could actually stick it all in a football field. I mean, that was mind-blowing to me, and he's talking about that. So he says, you know, here's literally where I'm coming from on this, and the energy industry is going, we're making record profits. Why kick up a fuss?
Sure.
You know, we're making a ton of money on this thing. So what's happening here is they're saying ESG, and even, you know, you would think who gets hurt by this? The oil companies, because you're investing more in environmental, social, and governance companies, and yet the energy companies are going, cool, our stock price is shooting up as a result. We're not hurt by this. Who is hurt by this?
The investor.
The investor. The end investor is hurt by this stuff. Because what is it that they're telling you here in this article? DOL's ESG rule proposal bodes well for 401ks. Let me take this and just translate it for you. The proposed rule bodes well, extremely well, for ESG investment and managers, especially because the regulator clarified that target date funds and other default products that use the investment criteria are permissible in 401ks because of what? The single department labor rule proposal, prudence and loyalty in selecting plan investments and exercising shareholder rights, would modify requirements outlined in the tool rules from last year. And in essence, here it is. They are citing two rules saying that financial factors in selecting plan investments and fiduciary duties regarding proxy voting and shareholder rights. Fiduciary. The issue is that you have investments that historically have not done that well. And it's gimmicky and it's high cost. You have more expenses in these things because the investment managers can charge more because they can say we're doing something.
Right. And what part of the Uniform Prudent Investor Act, you know, talks about environmental, social, and governance?
Not a single part of that book.
Yeah.
None of it.
Nuts.
Well, I don't know if you saw the article this morning in investment news about Walgreens settling a 401k lawsuit for $13 million.
Big deal.
All due to target date funds.
Really?
Yeah.
You know that they got sued. You know that there was a lawsuit. That's the point you're making,
right?
Over target date funds. And what about target date funds?
Well, what they said was that the company was sued in 1990. It failed. Mm-hmm. This is Walgreens failed in its fiduciary duty by opting to keep this particular company's target date funds on the plan menu. Mm-hmm. Use of the funds cost participants $300 million in savings.
Wow.
That they could have realized if more prudent investment options had been chosen between 2014 and 2019, according to the lawsuit. However, an expert hired by the plaintiffs later calculated potential damages as $34 million. Mm-hmm. Based on compensation to other target-date investment tracked by Morningstar.
Well, the issue here, though, and the thing that gets me, is you look at this and they're saying, here, you guys paid too much money. Your visible fees were too high.
Mm-hmm.
But when are they going to look at it and go, here's the problem, lack of diversification, over-concentration in areas of the market that have the lowest long-term expected returns, and increase volatility, and what's the cost of that? And in calculating it, it's not going to happen because all of these different providers of target date funds do the same exact things. That's why they look like each other. You can't sue everybody.
Right.
If everybody's driving 60 miles per hour down a 55 down the interstate, you know, the reality of it is they're not going to go and pull every last person over for doing that. And that's why these companies get away with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody's going to come after all of them. And here it is. Just another example. This is why you must be an informed investor. You can't go and abdicate a responsibility. You have to get involved in the process. And that is literally what I've been saying for 20 years. And it's not changing anytime soon. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. You want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.